GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit jltus.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Thanks for joining us. I'm a scientist, author, and entrepreneur, and I founded GreenSense, so they let me serve as host.
I'm Bob Kessler, executive producer. What will food be like in 10 years? There's some pretty crazy innovative things, innovative ideas here with the Food Futures Lab. And, you know, the very, very dirty Chicago River has really turned things around thanks to the help of everyday people. So we'll find out more about that. But first, we'll get to know a family-owned business that's been around for 30 years that's all about the nuts and bolts of solar.
Going green is about more than sexy high-tech hardware. Yes, the latest innovations are often exciting and thrilling, but just as important are the nuts and bolts of sustainability. And we're going to meet a company that literally is about nuts and bolts. Solar Roof Hooks been growing rapidly in the solar industry by working its niche, providing innovative, simple, and effective mounting solutions for residential rooftops. And joining us is Rick Gentry, VP of Sales, to tell us more. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you, Robert.
Well, nuts and bolts, solar panels. I guess we don't think about that all the time, but at the end of the day, if those panels aren't connected properly, they're not going to stay where they need to be. What makes your hardware special and unique from your standard garden variety screws and mounting hardware?
So Solar Roof Hooks is a division of Quick Screws International, and Quick Screws International specialized in woodworking screws for over 30 years. So what we did was, when we started the company, we took those same philosophies that we used to put screws into wood making cabinets, and we used that to put the mounting hardware onto the roofs, which is going into a wood rafter. So that was the first concept. And then, more or less, our philosophy here is, let's keep it simple. Let's make it easier for the installers to use, take away any problems that they would have installing, and make it the easiest, most efficient experience to install on the roof with a product that will last the test of time.
Solar Roof Hook was launched right in the midst of the Great Recession, right around 2009. That was a pretty big gamble to go green at that time. Who was the champion and made that decision?
So there's a few people involved with that. The one of the owners, Debbie Wiener, was always talking to her husband, Greg, telling him that we should get into solar. There was a few different factors involved. The recession obviously hit Quick Screws pretty hard. We lost about 40% of our business. So we were looking just for something new, a new market to sell to. Those few things combined with them getting on me, I'm the national sales manager. I'm the one responsible for growing and making sure that we all have jobs here. So I walked down and I went to a solar installer, a local guy. I asked him, you know, what hardware he's having problems finding. And he handed me this roof mount that he uses on a tile roof. And basically we sourced it, got him in, got him the price. He ordered a year's supply from us. And that was the first product we brought in and the initial launch of the product. Being as that we had nothing in this industry, it was all uphill for us. So it wasn't as much a gamble to really get into the solar industry as an offshoot of another company, because we had already had the backing that, you know, that was a stable entity. So it was just, now we're going into a new field and it's been uphill ever since.
A lot of manufacturing businesses are family owned and they're dying. They're having a tough time with low cost production offshore. And Solar Roof Hook has been a family owned business for close to 30 years. How have you met the challenge of staying in business over 30 years with so much changing out there?
Just to correct you, we are not a manufacturing company. We are an importer. We are very good at importing. We have been importing products. Our screws we make in Taiwan. We've always made in Taiwan, some parts in China. We've been very successful at that. And that was how we got into this. We went overseas. We found a supplier in China. You know, we did our due diligence on how we always check the factories, make sure that they're up to snuff. And that was kind of our philosophy has always been that. So basically, we order the parts overseas, we bring them in here in mass quantities, and stock them here ready to go.
How have you stayed in business for 30 years? What's been the success and the key?
You know, I think we all work hard. I mean, I think hard work creates good luck. There's a few things about family owned is that we move fast. We react quickly when things aren't working. We scrap ideas if they're not working. If they are working, we capitalize on them and build on the momentum. You know, we just take anything that we can, any indication that something's going to work. And sometimes we'll roll the dice. Most of the times that's worked. A few times it hasn't. But the owner here is always willing to put his neck out at times if he thinks, you know, if it looks good. And we have a few people that are saying it's good, and we check it out with our customer base. We'll bring in a new product on just as much as that, and launch it throughout the country. We do an excellent job of marketing. I think marketing is probably one of our biggest assets here, where we'll do, you know, we market in every magazine, every major magazine. We do full page ads. We spend a lot of money on marketing, which helps our sales department, you know, come in easily, close deals that are, we call them warm leads. So we don't have to do a lot of, you know, upfront work. People are coming to us saying, hey, we're interested in this product.
Besides seeking a new market, what else made you want to specialize in solar panel mounting hardware?
The attraction at that time was it was a growing market. We were in a shrinking market. So, and we didn't see, I mean, obviously at the time, I think the customers that have already used products, it was like 0.2% or some ridiculously low number. So the upside as far as where can we sell products to was huge, and it still is. There's a lot of roofs out there. You drive down the street, you'll see a lot of roofs without solar. So the customer base is there, and future customers are there. And it's exciting too. And I think the other side is that, you know, we're part of a green movement. We feel that, you know, there are some good things with solar, and we're helping the environment.
A lot of green innovators are upstarts who are just launching their companies for the first time. They often have great ideas, but they may lack some business experience or other fundamentals. What advice do you have for them?
I didn't start this company. Our CEO did. And one of the things I saw him do, and I thought was special, is that we were very conscious of where we put our resources. And to the point where, you know, we had used furniture in here for the first 10 years. We weren't going off and buying these extravagant offices and these high level phone systems. And we kept things on the bare bones minimum, and we watched our dollars. And, you know, when things made sense to start investing in those types of things, then we did. But really it was all about making sure that we could cover payroll, pay the vendors off, and keep us afloat. If you're going in this trying to be, you know, just living the lavish lifestyle, then you might want to rethink what you're doing. You got to have the money coming in to back it up first, and then you can start doing those other things.
Well, Rick, thanks for sharing the nuts and bolts of solar with us and what it takes to survive as a green family business.
Thank you, Robert.
That's Rick Gentry, VP of Sales for Solar Roof Hook. I'm Robert Colangelo, reminding you to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports Green Sense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together Green Sense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep GreenSense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at GreenSense Radio, thank you.
Food and how it's raised, grown, and distributed plays a huge role in the future of our planet. The Institute for the Future recently took part in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Food Forward Summit. Joining us is Sarah Smith with the IFTF's Food Futures Lab to share with us some of their new insights on food innovation. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
Well, you're calling your latest research report Recipes for the Next Decade. You're not presenting recipes in this report like how to make a casserole, but you're presenting recipes on how food can innovate and change in the next 10 years. So let's take a look at each of your ingredients for this recipe, and you can elaborate and tell us why they're important. So let's start out with scalable biodiversity. Big words, what's it all mean?
So we typically think of biodiversity in terms of a variety of plants or animals. And there's been some anxiety about this because there are estimates that we're losing hundreds of thousands of species every year. But at the same time, we're actually learning a lot more about this enormous amount of diversity at a much smaller level, and those are microbes. And so scalable biodiversity and this ingredient for innovation, we're thinking about these microbes across scales, about how the bacteria in our soil and in our food production facilities and in the human gut all really present new opportunities for the next decade.
Would probiotics sort of fit into this?
Yeah, absolutely. So all of the increased interest in the human gut microbiome is part of this. And a lot of this is being enabled by really low-cost DNA sequencing and our ability to actually measure and analyze and understand what is living in our guts and in our environments and starting to make some of those connections between that and human health outcomes.
Cloud intelligence. What's that have to do with food?
So cloud intelligence is probably the most technology-focused ingredient for innovation in this report. And it really draws from the research of Institute for the Future's technology team about the growing number of objects in our environment that are getting connected to the cloud and also being augmented by artificial intelligence. So in this recipe, or this kind of ingredient for innovation here, we're thinking about, you may have heard of the Internet of Things, the kind of internet-connected sensors. And in this case, for agriculture, it's really going to enable resources like water, but also will have some implications for our food distribution and manufacturing systems as well.
Another one, which I think may be code for GMOs, is experimental biodesign. Talk a little bit about this and compare it to GMOs.
Sure. So there's this advancing field of synthetic biology that is really changing the way that we think about designing food. So yes, biodesign does include some genetic modification. And where we see a lot of experimentation with this right now is in the efforts to find more sustainable alternatives to animal protein. So if you've heard about cultured or lab-grown meat, that's a part of this. The other place where people are really experimenting right now is to make things like animal-free milk or eggs. And so I think as it compares to GMOs, it includes some of that, but it also kind of expands it. And I think over the next decade, a lot of what we have seen in our research at Institute for the Future is that our ability to edit these kind of building blocks of life is only going to keep advancing. And so part of this ingredient is about understanding the scientific process that's happening there, as well as establishing some kind of new ethical and regulatory guidelines for this field as it continues to emerge.
Let's back up for a second. You mentioned synthetic milk and eggs. Elaborate on that.
Sure. So one example that's contained in our Ingredients for Innovation report is a company called Clara Foods. And they're a new startup, one of several who's basically using a process where you modify yeast so that it produces, in their case, egg proteins. And they kind of use the analogy of brewing beer, which many people are comfortable with, where you have some yeast that brews beer. In their case, they have modified yeast so that it brews eggs. And you can maybe even imagine kind of visiting a microbrewery of the future that is not brewing beer, but is instead brewing eggs or milk or some of these other animal proteins that we're trying to replace.
So it won't look like an egg or look like white milk, but it'll have the same characteristics at the protein level. Is that correct?
And in some cases, it will look the same. It could look like egg whites, and you can use it interchangeably in a recipe. One of the other things that they are able to do is, because you're creating the specific proteins that you want within an egg, some proteins are better at binding and some are better at fluffing. And so in a recipe, there's functions that you want an egg to serve. And in this case, you could even get more specific about, I want to brew an egg that's great for baking. So you can be very specific about which proteins you want to include in that egg white.
You're listening to Green Sense. I'm Robert Colangelo, and I'm talking with Sarah Smith with the Institute for the Futures Food Futures Lab about some of the interesting recipes and constituents that'll make up food for the future. Well, boy, all these terms are very new to me, and here's another one, rewritable narrative. What's that all about?
By rewritable narrative, we are really thinking about who and how we tell the stories about our food. We maybe used to live in a world where one marketing agency could control a brand's identity, and a few government agencies could pass down kind of official nutrition or dietary guidelines. And we see that that is no longer the case with this explosion of food bloggers and Instagram celebrities, and just many, many more voices entering into teaching us about how and what we should eat. And not only are there more voices, there's also a lot more mediums in which this can happen. And so in this ingredient for innovation, we were especially looking at how the emerging technologies of augmented and virtual reality might combine with our food experiences in the next decade.
Well, there's so much in this report, and we're not going to be able to cover it all on this show, but I'll hit a few other key highlights. The report mentions that over the next decade, we'll gain faster, more dynamic ways to invent flavors. How will this be accomplished? And what about healthy, fresh, local eating? Are these two issues in competition?
So I think when we hear invent flavors, people often probably think of like the next new flavor trend in a bag of chips or something like that. And I want to encourage us to think a little bit more broadly here. And part of this forecast was really inspired by some of the work that I saw firsthand at the fermentation lab at Noma restaurant in Copenhagen. And there were chefs and microbiologists kind of working side by side to create new flavors. Chefs are always trying to create new flavors and working with the ingredients and really quality food sources that they have on hand to create new experiences for their eaters. And a really cool thing that was happening at Noma was they had kind of hacked together this little device that they were calling an umami meter. So umami being that kind of basic flavor that lends a lot of savory deliciousness to food. And they were able to actually measure the amount of umami in, or the amount of glutamate, which is kind of the substitute for that, in some of the dishes that they were making. So it's part of this ingredient for innovation is really about the ways that new technologies and kind of low-cost sensors and things like that will enable more people like chefs and more everyday people to really experiment with and create fun and incredible new flavor experiences.
That's Sarah Smith with the Institute for the Future, Food Futures Lab, telling us about the recipes for the next decade when it comes to food technology. I'm Robert Colangelo, reminding you to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. The Chicago River is nationally known for being dyed green every St. Patrick's Day, but those from Chicago understand that maybe it didn't always have to be dyed green because it was used as a repository for waste, debris, and sewage. Now, the 156-mile river system is on its way to becoming ecologically healthy. Joining us is Margaret Frisbee, Executive Director of the Friends of the Chicago River. Welcome, Margaret.
Hi, Robert. How are you?
Your organization's been around for almost 40 years. When was the river most neglected and impacted by industrial operations?
Well, I would say probably almost for the last 150 years, minus the last 10. It was part of the sewer system. We dumped our industrial waste in and really abused the river in all kinds of terrible ways.
Isn't that amazing when you think about how much of a gem water is to Chicago? that we did not take care of that in the way that we were supposed to? What's changed out there?
Well, I think people's awareness that the Chicago River system, like other urban rivers, can be part of the benefits of living in the city. Cities were built on rivers, and largely across the world, we treated them poorly. And people are thinking today that waterfront property is valuable. We appreciate outdoor recreation. And so many people live in cities that we desire open space that's clean and healthy for everybody.
So who was the champion and who headed up the initiative to clean up the river? Was it NGOs and nonprofits like yours? Was it government or was it business?
Well, you know, it really started with people. The foundation was a person who wrote a story called Our Friendless River. And it was published in Chicago Magazine in 1979. And people called him up and said, we want to be part of the group that you called for. How can we help? And so our first meeting was 100 people came out in October of 1979, willing to roll up their sleeves and make a difference. So it started with people.
How challenging was it to first get this ball rolling?
Well, when you think about a river that has been straightened, it's been dredged, it's even been reversed, and it's part of the sewer system, people lack the imagination to think that the river ever could be healthy and a wonderful natural resource where people were canoeing and kayaking and in water taxis, you know, and all the things that are happening now. But the fact is that, you know, determination and hard work and partnership really paved the way so that government agencies started to listen, corporations started to pay attention, and they changed their view and really decided that the river was an asset for everybody.
People want to work, live, shop, recreate, and play along waterfronts. What do you see was the catalyst to all this development happening in Chicago along our waterways?
Well, the real foundation of all of it is cleaner water. And so the Water Reclamation District, who manages sewage and stormwater for Cook County, embarked in literally a 50-year project to stop combined sewer overflows, meaning sewage and stormwater and industrial waste, overwhelming our sewer system and ending up in the river. So that was the key catalyst to change the water quality, and then there's been a lot of improvements since. So the water itself is much more appealing, and so people are willing to be near and in and on it.
Let's talk a little bit about water quality. What are some of the biggest strides made along the way to improve the quality of water?
Well, certainly the tunnel and reservoir plan, this big giant tunnel system that has really removed a lot of the sewage that used to go into the river. So on an average day, the ambient water quality is much better. There's sewage effluent disinfection, which is, you know, it's a wonky term, but basically it means that we're cleaning anything that ends up in the river through a point source, through the sewage system, that's actually being cleaned up to a really clean level. And so it makes the water so much better. And so those are the big things. We still have challenges. Stormwater runoff has pollution in it. You know, there's still some combined sewer overflows, but overall it's so much better.
Where is the Chicago River now in terms of being clean, if you compare it to other major cities? And how far has it come, and how far do we have to go?
Well, I would say at this point, we're finally doing pretty well. We've reduced the amount of, you know, waste that used to go into the river dramatically. So the number I've heard tossed about is 85% of combined sewer overflows that used to impact the river now don't. And so, again, you know, if we look at other urban areas, we were behind a little bit on sewage effluent disinfection, but now that's in place. So it's happening and those discharges are clean. But, you know, we have a way to go. We have to really take seriously the stormwater runoff pollution, the fact that we still have combined sewer overflows. I mean, sewage is toxic to people. It's toxic to wildlife. And so, you know, I would say if we were going to go on a scale of 100, we're still probably in the 75%, but we were probably in the 20%. And so we've made great strides, but we really have to seriously concentrate on these complex problems that will get us to, if we solve them, we get to the point where we actually have a river we can swim in.
As you mentioned, as people recreate and shop and play along the river, like you said that they're going kayaking in the Chicago River now, they're going to become much more responsible for this asset, this natural asset. How much does education and outreach have to play in getting people to be more committed to cleaning up the river?
Well, I think it plays a tremendous role. I mean, there's a perception because of the legacy of the Chicago River system that the river is more polluted than it is. And so when we explain to people how far we've come, what's really going on, and especially when we talk about wildlife, people get really energized. You know, there's 70 species of fish in the Chicago River. There's beavers, there's muskrats, there's turtles, there's great blue herons. You know, all of that helps people understand that the river is cleaner and better than they really thought it was. And so it helps them kind of, you know, if you care about fish or you care about wildlife, you start to think about water quality and how it might impact them. So it builds awareness, it cultures a stewardship ethic, and really, you know, helps us connect with people so that they start to believe that the river not only is better than it was, but it has even more possibility.
Goals are a great way to sharpen the senses and to get productivity. Is the government or nonprofit setting goals to the point where we might be able to swim and fish?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, really right now, the water quality standards that were approved in 2011 for the Chicago River system after a decade of advocacy literally call for swimming in many portions of the river. The trick is when you have so many different sources of runoff pollution and sewage overflows and, you know, which are impacted by climate, so we're battling that. We have to look at the whole system and figure out how do we get to the point where we swim. So we're working together with government agencies, with municipalities, the Water Reclamation District to say, what are the sources that remain and how do we solve them and who needs to be at the table to do it? And that's something that a lot of people are committed to that, in, you know, 10 years ago, maybe they weren't, but today they are. So it's really exciting.
Our mantra at the show, Margaret, is small actions multiplied by millions of people yield big environmental results. In closing, what suggestions and recommendations do you have for individuals, things they can do to make the river better?
Well, I think the number one thing is people have to realize if they live in the Chicago River watershed, they need to know that their houses and their businesses are connected to the river. So we have a program called Overflow Action Days, and the first thing people can do is sign up for that. And what it does is it reminds you that the water going down your drain, everything from your toilet, your shower, your kitchen sink, your dishwasher, your washing machines, all ends up in the river. So what's going into the drains is going in the river, so you want to keep, you know, products that are unhealthy out of it, but you also want to conserve water to keep it out of the sewer system and think about how water conservation adds up. You know, it, literally, if you flush your toilet, that can be 20 gallons. So if everybody, you know, if a million people stop flushing their toilets as many times a day, we're talking about millions and millions and millions of gallons kept out of the sewer system and therefore kept out of the possibility of a combined sewer overflow. So that would be the number one thing, is to realize you're connected to this wonderful waterway and your personal actions can make a difference.
That's Margaret Frisbee, Executive Director of the Friends of the Chicago River. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Support our Podbean patron drive. It's simple. Visit the Green Sense Farm website and click Be My Patron button. Now's the time to support independent media more than ever so we can continue to bring you great guests and hear about their sustainable innovations. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. All you have to do is stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.